Leaning Toward Wisdom, the podcast. You are listening to episode 11 of season 2020. You collude in your own death. Welcome inside the Yellow Studio. Today is Friday, July the 17th, 2020. We're still in the middle of the pandemic. Well, I say we're in the middle of it. We don't know where we are in it. We know we are in the midst of it. Man, let's hope that it's way more than the middle, but what do I know? Clearly not enough. You heard the title right of today's episode, You Collude in Your Own Death. Sounds just downright cheery, doesn't it? Hey, are you not inside the new community? I'm going to put a link in the show notes. Just find episode 11 of season 2020 up at the very top. I will put a click here to join. It's completely free. In fact, I'll just make this easy. Go to leaningtowardwisdom.com/join. leaningtowardwisdom.com/join. And that will put you in the community. If you want access to exclusive content, like today I'm doing a video. I wasn't going to, but just enough of you nag me and say, yeah, we kind of, I don't know. You like seeing me do it. Some of you have pushed me to try to do something live, and I'm like, no, I'm going to draw the line right here. I'm willing to do video, but I ain't willing to go live just yet. But if you want exclusive content like video, or better yet, I did two videos reviewing the music of 1972. I haven't yet begun the project to work on 1973, but I plan on it. This is the music of my youth, 1972. In 1972, I turned 15 years old, and so I began with that year. It was a year that I got my full-blown driver's license and car and wheels, and so it was kind of a coming-of-age year. But I did two videos because, well, there was so much music in 1972. If you would like to see those videos are exclusively inside the community. They are found nowhere else. You won't find them anywhere else on the web. You won't find them anywhere. That's the only place where they exist. I have moved away from Facebook, so that you know. So when you go to leaningtowardwisdom.com/join, you are not taken to the Facebook group. The Facebook group is still alive, not quite active. You can go back to the last episode if you care and find out about that. Or if you want, join the community and you'll find out about why I'm basically leaving Facebook. All right, let's get this show on the road, shall we? My pondering about this particular thing, well, one aspect of it. My pondering really began with the Bible. Not a big shock for many of you, because you probably know how important faith is in my life. I had heard this story my entire life. I grew up sitting in a pew at church as a little boy, listening to old preachers tell the story recorded in Luke chapter 15. It is the story known as the parable of the prodigal son. And as a little kid, I would sit there and I would wonder, why this son? Why did he get this wild hair to confront his dad, make such a bold request as that inheritance that I got coming when you die? I just want it now. Give it to me now. And then I wondered, if that weren't bad enough, I wondered, why did his dad do it? Why did his dad give him what he wanted? I remember thinking, the adults in my life, they don't indulge me like that. I mean, I can ask for really simple, stupid stuff, and be told no on a quite regular basis. But he takes the money, this son, whatever else he got. I don't know what that inheritance looked like. Takes it, splits, leaves home. That baffled me. You know, I'd never really had the urge to run away from home. Well, to be more accurate about that, I really did never have the urge to run away and stay away for very long. There were times that I wanted to run away. I mean, what kid doesn't? But I didn't want to stay away. I mean, like, come nighttime, I'm home. You kidding me? Time to eat, go to bed. But I figured I got it okay. My life is not bad. And that's where it all started for me, wondering why this son, why didn't he realize how good he had it? Now, of course, I knew the end of the story because I'd heard this story before. I don't remember the first time I heard it. I just remember hearing it over and over and over again. So I already knew in advance how this thing was going to end. But it made me wonder at the beginning of the story, why doesn't he just already know this? Why can't he just get some sense that, you know, life here is pretty good. It's pretty good. Even if the dad hadn't given him the inheritance life, how bad could life be? Mostly, you know, I just wondered how long he was in that far country. That far country. Left home and went to this far country. The Bible says that, you know, he just lived it up. I mean, just absolutely, he did everything he was big enough to do, and then some. And I wondered why did he have to lose everything before he gained clarity, before he was able to have clear enough thought to realize, you know, back home, it's pretty good. Back home's pretty good. I need to go back home. I thought, you know, why couldn't he have lost a little bit, lost some portion? No, I mean, he had to be completely destitute. He had to lose everything. I don't know how vast it was, but it was enough that he evidently could live it up for quite a while. That was likely my first serious pondering about delusion. Delusion. And my introduction to the fact, and yes, it's a fact, that every human being, all of us, are fully capable of self-deception. Seeing things inaccurately. Believing things that are not true. In fact, I'll go you one better. We are able to completely fabricate things. Yes, we are able to utterly, colossally lie, not only to others, but to ourselves. Well, some months ago, I put my own sermon about this little story online. It was kind of at the beginning of this pandemic. But I approached it from the perspective of the father. All the sermons that I heard growing up really approached it from the perspective of the son. And that's valuable, but, well, I'm a father and a grandfather, so I was looking at it from his perspective. And by the way, the father did not deceive himself. He was seeing clearly the entire time. And thankfully, his clarity served both of his sons. I'll put the sermon, if you care to listen to it. It's a video at YouTube, but it's not really a video. It's just audio. But I put it at YouTube. You can find it over my personal website as well. randycantrell.com/paths. Paths. Well, self-deception and delusion, that's an everyday conversation in my work of coaching executives and leaders. 20 years ago, I bought and I read a book. I'll put a picture of the cover of this book in the show notes. This book, it captivated me because it joined two topics that I was highly, highly interested in then and still am. And it was 20 years ago. This book came out in the spring of 2000. And the book joined together these two topics that I cared a lot about. and still do, and that is leadership and self-deception. In fact, that's the title of the book, Leadership and Self-Deception. It is subtitled Getting Out of the Box. It was produced by the Arbinger Institute. Well, leaders of every ilk are prone to self-deception. The emperor has no clothes, right? That fable kind of leaps to mind. Do you know that story? I'm not going to tell it. Google it. I mean, here's a king completely self-deceived. But leaders aren't unique. It's not something that's just the purview of executives or leaders. It's a complex issue, and our quest to simplify things, as we are all kind of want to do, that really just, that's an irony all its own. That as complex as things are, and the more we try to oversimplify them, the more complex they seem to get, and it contributes to our delusion and our false assumptions. Because we need these neat, tidy things, and so we make things neat and tidy that are not neat and tidy, and therefore we fog ourselves all up. Kind of like my glasses when I'm wearing a mask. Well, fast forward, and this topic of delusion and self-deception, they intersect now with another conversation point that I have been fixated on for a few years, and that is addiction. Most notably, the whole opioid crisis. And I don't mean heroin, but I do mean fentanyl, and I do mean pain management, and I do mean prescribed drugs, and I do mean anti-anxiety and antidepressants coupled with said fentanyl. In my executive and leadership coaching work, I often have conversations with clients. In fact, I was thinking about this the other night. It's rare. This is horrible to say, but it may be indicative of the problem. Rarely does a week go by, 1 week, that I do not have a professional conversation with someone about this topic of substance abuse, addiction. It could be prescribed medication. It could be unprescribed medication. It could be illegal drugs. It could be alcohol. People whose lives have been horribly impacted by one or more of the above. You know, from people abusing these things to people not abusing, but people taking prescribed medications to family members and friends, to people who have witnessed the complete transformation of who someone was into someone that they just don't recognize. It's pretty universal. So almost weekly, having these conversations with people who have a family member, and that's usually the context. Usually it is an immediate family member who is struggling, and they are vexed at how to help this person get out of this pit, and they tell stories of how the person just can't seem to think. They can't seem to see accurately. They don't seem to understand or have any concept of what they are doing to themselves or to our family or our circle of friends, and they tell stories about these fogged over human beings that appear to be zombies of who they once were, impaired ability. And I will also, it's frequent that I will listen to a story and they inevitably will rehearse for me, having never met this person, having never even seen who they're talking about, but it's clear I can see how it's impacting their life, and they will recite to me how gifted and talented and sharp and smart and funny and engaging and on with the superlatives of how this person once was before they surrendered to some form of chemical dependency. And once in a while, I hear about recovery. Once in a while. And like the prodigal son, I won't say it never happens. I will just say that I haven't yet heard it. I keep waiting to hear it. And when I hear it, I promise you I'm going to make note of it, because it will be the first time I will have heard it. Someone who recovered quickly. The prodigal goes to the far country, and he spends and he sins, and he does it until he is spent. He does it until he is bankrupt in every way possible. And you wonder, could he have not stopped himself? I mean, what? Why didn't this happen sooner? In most of the cases that I hear, many years have elapsed before the self-deception and before the addiction are overcome. These success stories are, they're both rare and lengthy. I've yet to encounter a story of somebody who recovered quickly. The downward spiral seems to be this long, arduous descent into destruction, and there have been many times that family members have expressed to me a nosedive, and yet it's like the ground never arrives. They just continue in this free fall, this destructive path, and it seems that it just must get very, very bad before there's even hope of it getting better. I never really understood it, even though I grew up hearing the prodigal son story and realized that he had to get to a pig pen. And so for that reason, I have always kind of referred to it as a pig pen moment. We need to get to a pig pen moment sometimes before we change our mind, before we can see things clearly. We need, like the prodigal son, we've got to wake up in a pig pen, completely destitute of everything except pigs and whatever pigs eat. The title of today's show is a quote from an interview with a person who recovered from addiction. For over a decade, she took anything and everything that she could get her hands on. So she says, she said no to nothing. And if it had a numbing or a mind-altering capability, she jumped all over it. Once sober, she realized, in her words, she realized that she was colluding with her own death. And repeatedly, she talked about how deluded she had become because of the drugs. Opioids had thrust her into a fog where she had no idea how unclear her vision had become. She just knew that she wanted that feeling that she had chased ever since she took her first big drink of alcohol as a young teen. In fact, 13. Today, she's able to talk about how alcohol and opioids and other drugs, most especially marijuana, damaged brain chemistry and other physical cells, and how they also negatively impact our mental health. Craving the pleasure they can provide, no matter how destructive, no matter how temporary that feeling might be, it threatened her life, and it is threatening the lives of millions and millions of people today. And when I heard her say, "You collude in your own death," when you behave this way, you collude in your own death. You don't know it, but you are colluding in your own death. I wrote it down for one, and I instantly felt a sadness. And it's the same sadness that I feel every time I hear a story or I personally encounter somebody who's been touched by opioids or any other addiction for that matter. Collude is defined as cooperate in a secret or unlawful way in order to deceive or gain an advantage over others. In the sense that she meant it, you're doing this to yourself. You're taking advantage of yourself. You are deceiving yourself. You are willing to contribute to your own demise, your own death. Well, the woman made up her mind that she would fix her addiction. And her plan in her fog state that she now clearly sees, but she didn't at the time, her plan was, the minute she heard disease associated with what she was going through, the minute she heard her addiction described as a disease, she thought, well, diseases can have cures. So I know what I'm going to do. I'll cure it. I'll cure my disease, and then I'll be able to use to my heart's content. Sounds like a plan. Sounds like a plan. It was a novel plan, I'll give you that. She figured if her addiction was a disease and she'd cure herself, then I'll just pick up right where I've left off. She said she never turned down any drug. But with addiction, this is a quote, if you can manage it, then it's really bad news. Well, that got my attention because I thought, boy, is that not right. I mean, that's completely correct. If you can manage it, then it's really bad. Meaning, it's detrimental to every addict if they are able to be highly functioning while being an addict, because they are not able to suffer badly enough to overcome their addiction. They are highly functioning as addicts. They are able to manage their addiction, and that makes it even worse for them. It was the first time I'd heard somebody articulate that. Made complete sense to me, a sober person. She said, addicts who can manage their addiction are the most hopeless because they're not going to change. I gave up everything I had so I could have a relationship with drugs, she said. Thankfully, it got really bad. Bad enough I had to do something. I was goal-oriented. That's why I was able to sacrifice anything and anybody for the drugs. It's a pretty sobering reflection, right? Well, she's able to say that now. Looking back now, she realizes that she wasn't able to channel that trait, that being goal-oriented. She wasn't able to channel that into anything productive. And so instead, she just gave herself over to the pursuit of the feeling that she got when she became drunk at 13. It just trumped everything in her life. And she never saw it for what it was, not at the time. It was only after she'd been sober for an extended period of time that she was able to see her addiction for what it was. I was not going to be stopped, she said. I was colluding in my own death and hurting a lot of people all along the way. Taking a good, honest look at myself, I had to take responsibility for myself. Now, there's a lot to this woman's story, because from 13 to 23, she did this. And if we believe what biologists and neuroscientists have proven, and I do, you know, that prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed until you're 25, then during some really critical years, this woman was abusing chemicals. And she admits that it changed the game for her, in the sense that she knows that she has talked with other addicts and they can more quickly accelerate their recovery than she was able to. What may have taken them a couple of years took her 9, because she had taken these at such an early age. She said, I had to be willing to change. What made me willing to change was the realization that I was never going to get enough drugs. Neuroscience tells us that the brain adapts to any drug that you take regularly by producing the exact opposite effect of that drug. They call it homeostasis. Right, you've kind of got this norm, and your body and your brain are working to get back to the norm. big spike due to drug ingestion, big compensation to get back to norm. Well, what happens? Well, now I need more drugs. Because that spike that I got from that last bump, it wasn't as intense as I really would have hoped it would be. And so you need more. I had to be willing to change, she said. What made me willing to change was the realization that I was never going to get enough drugs. So you can't get enough. You can't get enough of the drugs to escape. Her name is Judith Grisel, G-R-I-S-E-L. She is a PhD in neuroscience today, and she wrote a book entitled Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. Well, Judith's statement that serves as the title for today's show, it not only captivated me, but it troubled me. And it made me wonder about the ways that we are all capable of colluding in our own death. And while I'm interested in the opioid crisis, I'm interested in addiction, I'm interested in neuroscience, I'm interested in brain chemistry, I am particularly interested in brain chemistry and how it is altered by chemicals. I'm also interested in the main topic of our podcast, wisdom. Wisdom. I continue to define wisdom as getting it right in real time. The prodigal son was not able to get it right in real time. Judith was not able to get it right in real time. It's making up our mind that we are going to do the correct thing, the right thing, right now, at the moment. And it's demonstrated in the choices we make. There's a story in the Old Testament. Joseph, talk about a guy that could lay hold to an excuse and point fingers. Well, Joseph's got most all of us beat. Older brothers sell him into slavery. I mean, his life is just one calamity after another calamity, but he rises to power and he is given some pretty big authority. Yeah, until the boss's wife tries to seduce him. And in that moment, he does what's right. And he utters a rather famous word, or a rather famous phrase among we who are Christians. He wasn't going to commit fornication with this woman, who was the wife of his boss, but he's immediately thinking about his responsibility to God. And he says, how can I do this thing against my God? And he runs. In fact, he runs. She's got a hold of him. He runs completely out of his coat to get away from her. She, of course, falsely accuses him of molesting her and ends up in prison. So, but in that moment, that's getting it right in real time. That's as good an example as I can give you of making the right choice at the moment. He was not going to surrender to that temptation. Making up our mind to do the right thing at the moment. And it's demonstrated in the choices that we all make, the words that we use to convey meaning, the way that we interact with other people, the beliefs that we hold and embrace, the self-control that we exercise, and everything else that determines who we are and what we are. I suppose part of my quest to learn about this stuff is my lifelong commitment to sobriety. And I admit to you that I come by it honestly. I'm pretty hardwired to be sober. But I was also trained inside a Christian home where drugs and alcohol just didn't exist. And I endured high school in the 1970s without ever having taken a drink, without ever having taken a drag from a marijuana cigarette. I've been around more drugs than I care to confess. I've been around a lot of pills and a lot of alcohol and a lot of weed, but I've never partaken. Mostly because it would violate my conscience, it would violate my beliefs, but frankly, even if that weren't the case, I still think I would have refrained because I just want command of my faculties too much. I mean, since high school, I have joked, listen, I have a hard enough time sober. The last thing I need to be is drunk or impaired. You know, there are many days I feel completely sober and impaired. So, I mean, why would I want to sacrifice what I've already got when what I've got some days is just not nearly enough? So it's just not my thing, and it's never been my thing. And in that regard, I can't possibly relate to the person who is convinced that they can't live without it. I do not know what that feels like. I can have empathy and compassion, and I can try to understand it, but I'd be lying to tell you that I do understand it. I don't. Because I still today, now as an old man, I've never taken a drink of alcohol. I've never taken an illicit drug. And as for pain medications, well, I can tell you, and my wife can tell you, doctors have always struggled to appropriately dose me. You know, I had some years ago, I had a bout with what doctors suspected was gallstones. And it required, I think, 4 morphine shots before I stopped shuffling my legs, as they said. You know, I was doing that kidney stone shuffle, they called it. I didn't have kidney stones, but I couldn't keep my legs still. I was just pumping my legs. And the nurse said, you know, look, I mean, this is what we call writhing in pain. And the nurse said, put a number on the pain, 1 to 10. And I said, I don't know, 6 or 7. I mean, it just didn't seem that bad. And she's like, 6 or 7, look at him. For me, the interest isn't in the substance themselves, but it's in the influence that they have on the human brain and how they are able to completely change a person's mind and personality. And I'm fascinated by it, but in horrible ways, I'm fascinated by it. Alcohol is commonly seen as a drug that can provide courage, right? I mean, come on. I grew up hearing about this and seeing guys who acted with more bravado after they'd had a few. Courage that otherwise would not exist, by the way. Inhibitions that just seem to fade into oblivion with a few drinks. Judgment that is impaired, but without sensing it. This is the thing. I'm foggy. I'm not thinking clearly. But I've got all the confidence in the world that I see everything completely clearly. People declare they're fine. No idea how out of control they are. How else can you explain someone who gets behind the wheel of a car after having a few drinks and they somehow get on an interstate going the wrong way? And I just think about this. Think about the wrong way on ramp that you must navigate to even get on the highway going the wrong way. But they're able to do it. It happens around here. You hear about it frequently enough. And I keep thinking, you know, I'm sober and it could be a challenge to try to get on a highway going the wrong way on an on ramp and then, you know, it's just mind-boggling. No idea. No idea they're going the wrong way. A path to the grave. A path to the grave. After discovering Judith Greisel some time ago, I invested the 7+ hours to listen to her read her book, Never Enough. And today's show is an attempt to not share with you the 7 full hours, but to share with you a little bit about what she taught me through that book, coupled with some observations along the way and some other things that a few other folks along the way especially over the last 5 years or so that I've learned. There will never be enough drugs because the brain has this extraordinary capacity to adapt. And hence her title, Never Enough. She says most addicts die trying to satisfy an insatiable drive. Alcohol makes you feel like you're supposed to feel when you're not drinking alcohol. I thought that was an interesting line. I heard her say that. I don't know if she said that in a TED Talk or where, but alcohol makes you feel like you're supposed to feel when you're not drinking alcohol. That's what she thought. And that was a sign that she saw hanging behind a bar, and she admitted that it accurately said what she felt when she first started to drink at 13. Any modification in life produced by alcohol, for her, at first it was alcohol, that beat facing her life, she said, of ruin and, it ended up being a life of ruin, but her life of tedium, her life of regulations, her life of rules, her life of constraints. What she learned in time, she said, is that the substances were completely betraying her. I sought any opportunity to use mind-altering drugs and at any cost, she says. She traded herself away a piece at a time to alcohol, to cocaine, to meth, whatever she could get her hands on. Today, she speaks fondly of them all, most notably marijuana, except for cocaine. She doesn't speak highly of cocaine. And looking back, she said almost all of the memories are bad, really bad. She believes that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, but choice. She argues that addiction robs you of freedom. Drugs obscure freedom. I've read this before, but she uttered it in a way that was not quite as I'd heard it said before. Recovery is birth at the bottom. Recovery is birth at the bottom. Mostly I had read that before in Bible stories that I had known, like the one I alluded to at the beginning in Luke chapter 15, that parable of the prodigal son, which you will find in Luke 15, verses 11 through 32. Here this selfish, rebellious son approaches the dad, wants the inheritance. I want it. Give it to me now. And shockingly, he gets it. Shockingly, the older brother gets his too. And the older brother would have gotten 2/3. The younger brother would have gotten 1/3. Older brother stays home. He's got a lot more than the younger brother, but he stays put. Armed with these newfound riches, the younger son goes to this far country, lives it up, parties hard, pays the bill till he can't, loses his friends, destitute, now in a pig pen, feeding pigs. Kind of craving what these pigs are eating. That's how hungry he is. Recovery is birth at the bottom. And there in the pig pen, he comes to himself and he realizes that the servants in his father's house, man, they got it far better than I got it. They're not sitting in a pig pen. The only way for an addict to feel normal is to take the drugs. But it is always a short-lived outcome. So the brain works hard to return, according to Dr. Judith, to homeostasis. And that means more drugs are required to get the feeling that one is chasing. As Judas says, there's no free lunch. And changes to brain chemistry brought about by addiction, they are always in the wrong direction. I was watching an old episode of Boston Legal the other day. It was a great show. And one of the main characters, played by William Shatner, is Denny Crane. And Denny he jokingly calls it Mad Cow, but Denny knows that he's slipping, and he's slipping into Alzheimer's. And he goes to the doctor, and the doctor, they put him in some contraption, and they're checking his, where his brain lights up with these questions. And once he gets through the test, he comes into the doctor's office, and the doctor tells him, you know, the last time that you were here and we did these tests, you were stage 3, and now you're at stage 4. You are not now in anticipation of Alzheimer's. You're there. Admittedly, you're at the early stages, but you're there. There is no free lunch. Changes to brain chemistry are always in the wrong direction. Addiction never benefits the person in the long haul. And as I listened and as I read Ms. Grizzle's work, as a Christian, I thought addiction sounded a lot like sin. Temporary pleasure, fun in the moment, never enough to make one full, can't get enough, but the long-term cost, extraordinarily high. And another idea kept pushing to the forefront of my mind, and that is our choosing, our behavior, our responsibility, our accountability. The evidence compels me to understand that people are different in how we react and how we respond to various stimuli, like drugs or like alcohol. For instance, my metabolism and the way that I metabolize painkillers, I know is very different from most everybody I know. It takes a lot to impact me. And I grew up hearing adults talk about the potential negative impact of that first drink. And my Christian upbringing notwithstanding, it just seemed apparent to me that the wisest option for me, and really I thought the wisest option for anybody, would be simply just avoid that altogether, which is what I did. And I freely admit I did it out of conscience, I did it out of conviction, I did it out of fear, I did it out of desire to want to have control over my senses. And to this day, I have avoided taking my first drink. That's been my choice. I could have made a different choice. I'll never know what would have happened because I only know the results and the outcome of the choice that I did make. Leaning Toward Wisdom has the aim of helping us get it right in real time. If we can't get it right in real time, then let's get it right in hindsight. But let's get it right. Man, let's get it right. And that means our choices, our decisions that we make in real time, and even in hindsight, they need to be the ones that serve us best. Choices that benefit us. Not just ones that benefit us immediately, but ones that benefit us immediately, they've got to be contextualized. Meaning, what is the benefit? Is it moral? Is it immoral? Sin has a benefit. It's fun. It's pleasurable. Immoral. Does it build or does it erode character? Well, sin doesn't build character. It erodes character. But it's fun. Does it benefit us, but potentially harm others? And after the immediate benefit, then what? Well, our brain wrestles. Well, or it doesn't. There's the problem. Sometimes our brain doesn't wrestle with these and a variety of other questions that probably need to be wrestled with. We think it through or we don't think it through. We consider something carefully or we behave and we act impulsively. These choices, especially these first ones, I just can't get past the thought that they're on us. They're on us. Meaning, 13-year-old Judith made the choice to get drunk. And you could say, well, she was only 13. Listen, not every 13-year-old makes the choice to get drunk. She made a choice to get drunk. And to think that that's not on her? Yeah, that's on her. She made the choice. Nobody forced her to get drunk. She chose to get drunk. And then she loved it. Who knew? Recovering addicts universally also talk about the importance of getting out of the context of their substance abuse. Namely, they confess that if they were not removed from the people who surrounded them while they were using, while they were abusing, they would have never climbed out of the pit. Now, fantastically, they also admit that if they were to remain away from those people that they got high with, those people who supported them, those people that, oh, poor pitiful you, you know, those people that showed them all the sympathy in the world while they were abusing, those people that they thought were their friends, they could get away from those people. They could get sober, and they could only do it if they got away from those people. But they could stay away from those people, and they could stay away from those people for a long, long time. But if they, everyone, admit that if they were to go back and be in the proximity of those people, even after an extended period of time away, they would be instantly triggered with memories, and the urges would hit them immediately to use again. And quite frankly, many of them have experienced that, not just in thinking about it, but it's happened. More choices. More choices in, well, who's going to surround us? Who are your friends? Why are they your friends? The influences that we allow, that we permit to impact our lives. Consequences. It was Sir Isaac Newton who determined that what goes up must come down. There are always consequences. Wise decisions benefit us. Foolish decisions hurt us. And not just us, but other people too. Addiction has a few insidious components. And throughout all of my reading and throughout the things that Dr. Judith said in her book and countless others have borne this out as well, tolerance is up near the top. It's why the alcoholic has to drink more and more. The first experience with alcohol, however great it might have made you feel, it cannot be replicated with the same amount. And maybe it'll never be replicated. Dr. Judith reports that she never, ever felt as great and as wonderful and as whole as when she got drunk when she was 13. It never happened again. She pursued it for a decade and never was able to replicate it. But still, you try. Addiction knows nothing of moderation because it alters your brain chemistry, and addiction just keeps on asking for more and more. And as the title of her book says, there's never enough. There's just never enough. Addiction to drugs and alcohol, it also results in increasing the very things that the addicts are working really hard to escape or to avoid. It produces exactly the opposite of what you're going for. Dependence destroys us because we stop taking the substances and we feel worse than we did before we ever started taking the substances. I mean, it's like we only lower the quality of our feelings and our thoughts and our emotions from some already bad place from which they started. It's homeostasis. It's that balanced, normal state that we have. Substance addiction, it gives us these big ups and these big downs, and those swings grow increasingly impossible for people to manage. A life of false fixes. Yeah, there's a phrase I had to write down. A life of false fixes. I don't remember if Dr. Judas said it. There's another medical doctor that I was reading and paying some attention to, Dr. Pamela Peel. It's Peel, P-E-E-L-E. One of them said it. And I say that because of where it is in my notes. I had jotted that down. In the midst of it are some things that Dr. Judah said and some other things that Dr. Pamela, and Dr. Pamela is a medical doctor, some things that she said. So I figure it had to be one of them that said it. I've consumed substantial content from both of them and many others, but it was one of these two who said it. A life of false fixes. I wrote it down because it just seems so congruent with everything that I've read, everything that I've studied about the influence that opioids have on the brain, and frankly, addiction in general. It reminded me of that ancient Jewish boy who grabbed his inheritance and left home, the prodigal son. I keep coming back to him because, man, so much of it fits. His life fits that bill, a life of false fixes. And we're left to wonder, okay, what was he fixing? It was clearly a life of utter selfishness. He wanted what he wanted. And I can't do anything except conclude and suppose that most all of our foolish choices, and I don't mean about addiction or substance, I mean about anything. I've come to conclude that the majority of our foolish choices stem from that urge. That urge, I want what I want. Google the phrase cycle of addiction. I did. I'll put a link in the show notes. You can just click the link and you'll just see all the images that come up. There are just tons of illustrations. I'm going to embed one in particular that's got five kind of stages. It's called addiction cycle. I would attribute it to whoever did it, but I don't know. Because there's a bunch of these, and a bunch of these are the same. This one, it starts with emotional trigger. So you've got this circle at the top. Emotional trigger, and it flows clockwise to craving, and craving flows to ritual, and ritual flows to using, and using flows to guilt, and guilt moves right back up to 12 o'clock noon to, yeah, you guessed it. We've completed the circle, and we're back to emotional trigger. Every illustration that I looked at in that Google search seemed to display a life of false fixes because they're all cycles. It's just this treadmill that you just don't get off of. They don't end. They just perpetuate themselves, which seems to be the way that self-deception works, oddly enough. So I asked myself the question, what are we trying to fix? What are we trying to fix? Well, there's a lot of things, I suspect, that we're trying to fix. But at the heart of every problem seeking a fix seems to be one central thing. One central thing kept jumping out at me over the course of the last 5 years or so that I've been looking at this and reading about this and studying this and countless hours of YouTube watching and TED Talks and the like. To feel better about oneself. There it is. To feel better about oneself. I have spent way yonder too much time pondering that dilemma, the reason people want to feel better about themselves. And what I've seen is the easy tendency that every one of us have to look outside of ourselves for a solution to a problem of fixing how we feel about ourselves. Do I need to say that again? Did you catch it? I mean, just think about this. Because we've all got that tendency to look outside of ourselves for solutions to the problem of fixing how we feel about ourselves. A person doesn't need an addiction to surrender to that urge. We just need to be willing to look at ourselves as victims. And sadly, well, that road is smooth and easy. I mean, come on. Any of us can hit that on-ramp at highway speeds. Yeah, I'm a victim. How much time you got? I'll tell you how many people have victimized me. It seems chemical ingestion and the repeated act of ingesting chemicals or addiction change not just how we feel, but it clearly changes how we act. And at some point, likely very early, as Dr. Judah's story clearly shows about her getting drunk for the first time at 13, feels pretty terrific. At some point early on, maybe the first time, feels good. Till it doesn't. The problem is that great feeling is fleeting. And for her and for millions of others who may be so predisposed genetically or maybe even emotionally or both, there goes the cycle. You have just put yourself on the treadmill. Your choice to do that the first time, welcome to the Thunderdome, because now you're in. Now you're in. And somebody's going to die. For her, it continued for a decade, a 10-year run of chasing something that she never caught. And you don't know it until you do. And right about here, I have to insert my very favorite quote, "Everything is hard until it's easy." I'd give credit to whoever said it, whoever wrote it, but I don't know. And quite frankly, I haven't done it, but if you Googled it, I bet you I've said it more than anybody alive has said it. Maybe not. I didn't say it. I have repeated it. Dr. Judith spent a decade destroying her life until it dawned on her the truth of what a drug buddy, if I remember the story correctly, she didn't say it, but she acknowledged it, because when she heard it, she knew it was true. A drug buddy said, "There's never enough cocaine." At the time, that was the drug of choice. There's never enough cocaine. And by then, she had spent years and years and years chasing false fixes when the problem was staring right back at her every time she looked in the mirror. And I'm wondering, what did she see? When she looked in the mirror, what did she see? Did she see herself as a homeless drug addict? Did she see herself as a victim? Did she see herself as broken? Did she see herself as unfixable? What did she see? This much is clear. She did not see herself as she really was. Nor did she see her problems or her fixes as they really were. You know, I liken it to looking in a math book for the answer to a history question. I mean, everything about it's wrong, you know? And it's confusing. I mean, how confused are you going to be if you're looking in a math book for the answer to a history question? You know, it's going to be a lot of batting of the eyes and shrugging of the shoulders, and I don't have a clue. That's because clear thinking has left the building, and it has been replaced with self-pity, self-loathing. Every story I've ever heard about such things involves hatred and anger and resentment and bitterness. Every single one. The chemicals do that, but they don't do that before the selfishness kicks in. So I started reviewing all the stories that I've listened to through the years. Like I said, especially the last 5 years or so. Parents, grandparents, children, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, friends, young, old, doesn't matter. Some of the stories are about other people. Some of the stories are about themselves. Stories of people who went looking to fix a problem with a substance. And without exception, they all began with a choice to please themselves. Every person, every single story centers on a person who reached a point where they just made up their mind that they didn't care about anybody else more than they cared about themselves. Here's the irony. That is the moment that each of these people who surrendered to substance, that's the moment they lost themselves. Funny, not in a ha-ha kind of a way, but funny in how colossally backwards that is. But I find that that's true with or without substance abuse. That the moment that we commit ourselves to serve ourselves, we've lost ourselves. the more we focus on a self-centered way, the more broken we become. And the more we look at external excuses and the more we are willing to point fingers and blame other people, we'd be happy if not for them. Look at how badly they treated us, never realizing the carnage that we're causing. A middle-aged man told me of his struggles to hang on to a woman that he loved passionately since they were young. And her battles with substances of all kinds had wrecked her life. It had taken a heavy toll on his, if only because he refused to walk away. Her infidelity was extensive. He'd lost count. He described his own life, his own cycle of pursuing a life of false fixes. And it sounded every bit as bad as hers, quite frankly. And I was just sad. I was just sad listening to it. Does she realize the pain she's causing? I mean, you know, you got to ask the obvious. And I did. Not in the moment. But yeah, she eventually figures it out. And that just seems to make it worse because then she falls off the ledge and behaves even worse. Everything is hard for them. And it's going to remain hard until something tragic happens to one or both of them. She can't let go of drugs. She can't let go of alcohol. He can't let go of her. And they're both lost. And you just can't help but think that, man, it could be so much better. It could be so much better. But each one of them, you know, they're devoted to their own delusions. She's looking in all the wrong places for answers, and he's fooled into thinking that he can change her. You know, there are too many such stories in every naked city and in every naked town. Well, let's talk about coming face to face with the truth. For those who find a way out, their stories, I have found, are equally universal. And these are the ones that fascinate me the most. And I remain puzzled that boys, girls, men, women, young, old, in between, educated, uneducated, town folks, city folks, urban folks, country folks, people from backgrounds that could not be more different, but they all behave exactly the same way under the influence, especially of opioids. And those who climb out of the pit, they do it with help. But first, they have to make a different choice because they personally, individually, have to come face to face with the truth. For the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15, the Bible says in verse 17, "But when he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger?'" But when he came to his senses, coming to his senses meant that he finally saw clearly. And at that moment, self-deception left him. His mind was clear. His mind was accurate for the first time in who knows how long. He's thinking wisely now. Every person that I've ever talked to who recovered or who has a person close to them who recovered, they talk about a moment like that. A moment of truth, a moment of coming face to face with the truth. There are so many common denominators in all of this, and I continue to be really intrigued by this, at just how universal the stories are. You hear one, and it's just like the dozen that you heard before, and you hear another two dozen, and they seem eerily like all the ones that you heard prior. A moment of relief. Respite, and that's what they're seeking. And it's because these substances affect the human brain the same way. Further proof that we aren't so different, any of us. We got a lot more in common than we realize. So strong is the attachment to the substance and the pursuit of the feeling that few things, if anything, can detach a person from it. You know, you read and you hear stories of these scientists who work with these lab rats who will literally kill themselves for, you know, the filling of an Oreo cookie. Eat it until it kills them. This moment of pleasure. And we're no different. We're no different. We are seeking the very thing that we want, that we believe, some of us, that the substances will provide, that respite, that moment of relief from whatever we're suffering, whatever pain we feel like we are enduring, self-made or otherwise, that's what we want, and that's what we're chasing. And the more we chase it through these horrible choices, the worse it gets for us, even to our demise. Craving the very thing that's causing us all the damage. Craving to satisfy ourselves, which is at the heart of the problem, I suspect. We have met the enemy, and he is us. But we don't know that until we know it. We can't see it until we can see it. You know, it's like those hidden images in a print that's hanging on a wall. We stare at it until our eyes cross, struggling to see what everybody else in the room, they claim they can see it. And, you know, we think, they're lying to me. There's nothing there. And they tell us, well, step back a little bit. Okay, now squint your eyes. And we do everything that they suggest that we do so that we can try to see it, and we still can't see it. Now we think they're just messing with us. And then we see it plain as day. And it's one of those smack your forehead moments. And now we could step away from that print. We could not see that print for a long, long time. But the minute we walk in the room and we look at that print, bam, the hidden image just leaps right out at us. Well, why was that so hard earlier? Because everything's hard until it's easy. Every story of recovery that I've ever heard has a similar feel and tone. But unlike the exercise of peering into that print, those people had to endure some pain that was greater than the pain they were medicating. And that's important. Without that, many of them report they wouldn't have looked at truth. They wouldn't have seen truth. Nobody could say anything to me, they now report. And they use words like stupid and ignorant to describe themselves then when they were using. No, they didn't see themselves that way in real time. They would have never used those words to describe themselves in real time. One of the most common words that I hear, there's actually probably two, cloudy and foggy. No, not in meteorological terms, but in terms of their own brain. Their own thinking, cloudy, foggy. Well, now, these are not terms that express clarity and purity and accuracy and truth. The bigger term comes to the forefront when they speak about facing the truth. And I hear this word or some derivative of this word all the time in every single conversation. And the word is misery. Misery. I was just miserable. That's a pretty common refrain from every single one of them. But having the ability to recognize that misery, that's often required by some, you know, some jolt, some external force, some external influence. Often, it's tragic, and often it's law enforcement. Because many of them got arrested, many of them while driving. Others suffered violence. No big shock there, given the lifestyle. Beaten up, shot, stabbed. You know, something happened that grabbed them by the lapels, shook them like they've never been shaken before, and at that moment, or in some series of moments like that, they realized, I am miserable. I am miserable. I hate my life. boy, if I had a nickel for every time any of them told me that. I hated my life. And it was for each of them a moment of coming to their senses. All of those abilities to sense the accuracy and the truth of themselves and the lives that, well, the lives they had lost along the way. And it begins, mind you, it just begins to return. That hidden image in the print, clear. I see it, plain as day. They saw themselves. They saw their situation for what they truly were. And they saw it as a horrible way to live a life, colluding in their own death. The suffering they were attempting to escape, it was growing until it got so large that it got them in trouble, or until they figured out they just didn't want to endure the misery anymore. Dr. Judith said, the more you try to fill it with substances, the bigger it gets. The more you try to fill it with substances, the bigger it gets. Where do you go for the answers? Where do you go to fill whatever you sense may be missing? But there's another aspect to those questions that I think is important. And there's really two of these questions. Do the places you go, do they help you in colluding in your own death? Or do the places that you go help you in colluding in your own life? I think these are big questions that need to be asked and answered. The places that you go to fill in whatever is missing, do they help you in colluding your death, or do they help in colluding your life? Meaning, do they hurt you? Do they help you? Those seem to be central to this whole thing. You know, as I listen to experts and firsthand accounts, I realize that the management of our feelings, the management of our thoughts, that is central to our well-being. Substances, well, that just helps us avoid managing these things. And frankly, it just makes it harder to manage, and it makes it harder to figure out what we're feeling and why we're feeling. It's one of the grand things, I say grand and I tongue-in-cheek kind of, sort of, that is said about THC in particular, you know, the prime thing in marijuana. It does something that no other drug does, so far as I have come to understand as a layman in reading neuroscience and what they have discovered. It basically makes everything important. It makes everything sensational. You know what that does. As a result, it makes nothing sensational, and it makes nothing important. It's why there are all the jokes about, you know, the pothead who's rather indifferent about everything. Because the drug, over time, has numbed you to anything. Because at some point, it amplified everything. I'm real fond of saying to business people, if everything is important, then nothing is important, meaning there have to be priorities. And so it is with our senses. So it is with our feelings. So it is with our thoughts. Every thought that I have is not important. Some are more important than others. Every feeling, every sensation is not equal. But what marijuana does, it amplifies everything, and it makes everything important. And so over time, it makes nothing important. There's no ability to distinguish between anything, which is why so many, as we called them when I was growing, you know, the potheads were just like, meh, you know, I mean, didn't care about anything. There was just a big lethargy. Well, that explains why. I didn't know that at the time. You know, we just thought they were in a stupor. No, not really. There was something happening chemically in their brain that was making them indifferent about everything. Because it seems that to me that so many of us, maybe we're afraid of what we think. Maybe we're afraid of what we feel. But why? And what is that fear? And as I often do, I'll pick on myself to illustrate. Again, this is only because I'd rather pick on myself than anybody else. Well, that's not entirely true. There are a lot of people I would like to pick on, but that wouldn't be polite or kind. I manage my own thoughts and I manage my own feelings with faith, with reading, with writing, and with music. If you were to ask me the four, and I'm doing this with just me. I don't mean to exclude other people because other people are very important to the process, but I'm intentionally restricting it from involving other people and just, okay, what do you do? Well, what I do is lean on faith, writing, reading, and music. None of these activities could I even remotely conclude collude in my own death. That is, none of these are destructive for me. Nor are they destructive to anybody else. Each one of them, especially that first one, faith, they contribute mightily to life. And not just any kind of life, but a good life. A life guided by principles and morality and integrity and character and truth. Alienation, I pay close attention to words. Alienation is often a subject whenever conversations turn toward addiction. And experts tell us that opioids are especially effective at helping people battle suffering. That's why we have an opioid crisis. Got a lot of suffering, self-induced and otherwise. And there's high or strong suspicion that alienation is at the heart of suffering for a lot of people. Now, a challenge with alienation for me is the language itself, because it can depict something that is done to us as opposed to something that we feel ourselves. Alienation. I mean, what do you think? You know, when I hear the word alienation, I immediately am questioning who's alienating who. Maybe a more accurate term, and one that I also hear that makes more sense to me, is emptiness. That's something that we can all understand, and I think we can all own. Maybe you've never felt empty. I can't imagine it, but I guess it's possible. And it doesn't imply that it's been done to us. When I say, you know, when someone says, you know, they feel empty, I don't immediately think, well, who emptied you? You say alienation, and that's just kind of where our heads go, isn't it? Well, alienated, well, you know, who has alienated you? But I don't think that when I think of empty. When I think of empty, I'm wondering why. What's behind this? I'm not thinking of a who. And I think it also explains that language that I commonly hear and that quote that Dr. Judith uttered, the more you try to fill it with substances, the bigger it gets. Well, what is it? It's the emptiness. It's whatever we're trying to fill. And what are you trying to fill if not emptiness? I heard her say in an interview, it took me 15 years after getting sober to sit still. She described herself as being just in constant motion, just impulsive, compulsive, always, you know, just darting from one thing to another, just kind of a perpetual motion machine. And yet many addiction experts talk about how alienation and emptiness go hand in hand, or at least how they can go hand in hand. We want to find causes. We want to find reasons. And for every story of a person from a broken or a troubled home, you will hear stories of other people who fell into substance abuse, who came from a close-knit family, a strong community, seemingly every advantage under the world. And I don't mean rich. I just mean common, ordinary folks who grew up in nice homes and had perfectly fine families. So you don't have to come, I think, as Dr. Judith jokingly said, you know, she came, it was a perfectly fine home. She said it wasn't like I grew up in a terrorist camp or anything. I listen to the words that people use, and pronouns are particularly important. The pronoun I is always at the forefront. with an addict. Self-centeredness is fundamentally at the heart of it. But I would argue that self-centeredness is at the heart of every act of foolishness, all of us, addicts or otherwise, every act of foolishness that we engage in, self-centeredness is at the heart of it. And that feeds into the next observation, and that is the words that are missing. What words don't you hear when you talk to these people? The feelings that aren't expressed by the addicts. Well, I can tell you the words. They just jump. They jump out at you. They scream louder than if they had been uttered. Words like thanks, gratitude. You don't hear those. You don't hear those. Those who have and are recovering admit that those words absolutely positively were missing, and they also admit that those are the words to the way forward. Those are the words to the way back. And the only way that you can get there, they all have learned, the only way you get there is when you are not fixated on getting what you want. You can't get there and be selfish. You can't be thankful and grateful and be selfish. So you got to let go of one and you got to embrace the other. And there's a real path forward. I mean, I've heard too many stories. I've heard too many stories of people who abandoned a community that served them or was trying to. The prodigal son, he left home where his dad and his brother were. There is no indication that he'd been victimized at home, that he ran off because dad was a jerk. Maybe there were other unnamed family members. I don't know. We know there were servants there, to be sure. I mean, come on, it was home. Nobody kicked him out. Nobody pushed him away. He wanted to leave. And he wanted to leave for the exact same reason that every addict that I've talked to, every recovered addict, says the reason that they did. They didn't want the constraints anymore. Didn't want the rules, didn't want the regulations anymore. Want to be free. And in searching for freedom, they enslave themselves in the deepest, darkest dungeon that a person could. The prodigal, he enslaved himself in a prison of his own making when he goes into the far country. He neglected to be thankful for what he had. He wasn't deluded. After he left home, he became deluded, I would propose. He became deluded before he ever left the house. He became deluded before he ever went to the Father and says, I want what's coming to me when you die. Delusion hit him before we come to the story. The act of his delusion began when he made up his mind, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell Dad to give me what's coming. How does it end? Well, for too many people, it does not end well. Most people, 70 to 80% of people, drop out of rehabilitation programs within 6 months, according to American Addiction Centers. Medscape reports that over 44,000 people in America die every year to drug overdose. The Centers for Disease Control estimate that daily, every day in our country, 114 people die due to drugs. The cost in human lives is high if you only focus on those numbers. But here's what you can't do. You can't just focus on those numbers. You must compute the people in the lives of those 114 who die every day due to drugs. How many people are in their family? How many people are they friends with? How many people do they influence? How many people surround them or once did those 114 every single day? That's a staggering number of people. Permit me to share the summary of all, and I mean 100% of the people who admit they found their way out of the pit. And I will go on record and tell you that these people all found their way out of a pit of prescribed medication coupled with alcohol and in some cases an illicit drug or two. Every single one of these people, and I'm now up to a pretty fair number of these people, came away from fentanyl, hydrocodone, some other form of opioid that was prescribed, coupled with anti-anxiety meds or antidepressants. And 100% of them, I can hear from one, and they all say the same thing. I keep searching for an exception, and I just so far haven't found it. And you know what? Because of the nature of these chemicals and the brain, I don't think I'm going to. I've now talked to enough, I don't think I'm going to. I can't believe that was me. Every single person looks back now with a sober mind and with clear thinking, and they just cannot believe their behavior while they were taking these things, both men and women, young and old. Can't believe the lies, can't believe the cheating, can't believe the shameful choices and behavior, and every single one of them admit that prior to their substance use and abuse, they would have considered, it just would not have crossed their mind to do many of the things that they did. And now in hindsight, they just find it, even now, some of them years removed, find it incredibly hard to believe that they did it. They know they did, but it's hard to believe. It began with lying, 100%. It began with lying. Maybe first to others, but certainly to themselves. She loved me and didn't deserve what I did to her, he says. He cheated on her repeatedly. She had no clue. He lied to her daily, many times a day. He convinced himself that he deserved to behave the way he chose. I betrayed her in every way, he says as he looks back. He blew the marriage up, blew the family up, even though he clearly states that when he married her, he believed we'd grow old together. And until he was sober, freely admits he hated her. Hated her. Guilt and shame. Common to 100%. I would never admit it, she says, but I was so ashamed I couldn't stand it. Till I drank more or took more pills. Using anger and hatred to deal with the guilt and the shame seems to be universal. I burned everybody who loved me. They all say that. In one way or another, I burned everybody that loved me. And the people they turned on the most, those they had been closest to before they entered the fog. And once they were in the abyss, those with whom they were closest to became public enemy number one. And now in clear hindsight, they all readily admit that the people, they were trying to save me. They were trying to get me straight, but man, I hated them for it. I didn't want to hear anything they had to say. I hated everything and everybody, reports one, but they all expressed it in one way or the other. Mostly I hated myself, but I kept that as quiet as possible. Paying the piper can be expensive. Every sober person needs more than a brief chat to reveal the vastness of the damage they caused. And while a lot of them mention some financial or material related loss, it's not really where the focus is. It's not really where the conversations ever go. Each of them begin, each of them end the conversation, and each of them spend the majority of the conversation talking about the relationships that they destroyed, the relationships they damaged. And for most, there were some critical relationships that did get restored. In fact, they say if they had not been able to restore some of the critical relationships, they don't know that they would have ever recovered from the abyss. But every single one of them report relationships that weren't ever repaired, ever restored. Lost spouses, lost kids, lost parents, lost friends. Some damage so great that no matter how badly they want it, no matter how badly they may work at it, is just not possible. And too many of them report lost relationships because loved ones died while they were in the far country. Regret, enormous doses of regret, those are always part of the conversation. I mean, you can't help but listen and hear the regret that always follows these people. What might have been seems to be at the forefront of their lives now. And I'm just, you know, you're just sad to sit and to listen and to wonder if such a weight might compel some of them to go back into the abyss, because maybe they convince themselves that's where they belong, even though that's just another lie. It's another unclear thought, another self-deception. A father grows older, no relationship with his now-grown kids who remember the man who sank into alcohol, the man who treated their mother so poorly until she was forced to kick him out. Well, he's not the same man today, but in their minds, he's kind of frozen in time. He's still that guy. And frankly, they're still the little kids they once were. They're just sticking by their mom. And he wonders what might have been. A son grows lonelier, splintered his family. The strain on his parents, well, that took a toll on their marriage. They still love each other, but they just couldn't find a path forward together because, well, his mom was busy obsessing about his drug abuse while his father was working really hard to let him go so that he could continue to build a life with his wife. They couldn't figure it out. And today, now, an adult son wonders about the love that he broke apart. A wife grows grayer. Youth, that's long gone. Replaced with wrinkles and crinkles and popping joints. She's no longer a wife, but she once was. And he was her best friend. But her drinking and her over-medicating drove him away, closed him down. Coupled with her repeated infidelities. She remembers a time when she couldn't have imagined life without him. But today she realizes she's been apart from him longer than they were ever together. And she too wonders what might have been. I'm left thinking that the whole reason for the choice was to get away from the pain. Right? The whole reason to go hopping down this bunny trail is to get away from the pain. But the result is the compounding of pain many, many, many times over. There is no greater pain than the pain of watching somebody you love their addiction more than they love you. The prodigal son returned home to an elated dad who, well, he wouldn't even let him finish the speech that he rehearsed. If you read the story, he rehearsed this speech while he's in this pig pen. I mean, he's prepared to go and to beg his father, man, just let me be like one of your servants. Because even his servants at his dad's house had it better than he had it. But, you know, he comes walking up the lane, and I'm supposing how awful he must have looked. He didn't look anything like he looked before while he left home. But Dad didn't listen to the entire speech. Why? Because Dad is too busy being happy. Dad is too busy putting a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet and nice clothing over his shoulders. Dad is too busy telling the servants to go and prepare this banquet to celebrate the fact that his lost son is now home. And to the older son, he said this in Luke chapter 15, verse 32. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live, and was lost and has been found. I hope and I pray that more people who use fentanyl and other opioids and people who abuse prescription drugs as well as illicit ones, and people who use alcohol, I do pray and I do hope that more will come to their senses as this son in Luke chapter 15 did. There are just too many celebrations that are waiting for the opportunity. You know I'm not going to apologize for the length. They're as long as they got to be, right? It's episode 11. You collude in your own death. But that's not what I want for you. I want you to collude in your own life. It really is the whole point of leaning toward wisdom. It was the whole point when I began this exercise many years ago. And it's what still fuels me. Are you not inside the new community? I'm going to ask you to go to leaningtowardwisdom.com/join and do that. You'll have access to the video of today's show and all kinds of other exclusive content that you'll only find there. It's completely free. I'm not asking for anything except for you to join. I appreciate you clicking play. My name is Randy Cantrell. The website is leaningtowardwisdom.com. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio.